to the Divided Kingdom, the news program many of you have come to know and trust since 2003. Lou Caverly and I, Elizabeth Cuppet Caverly, are pleased with help from many of you to keep broadcasting this special program that gives you the real news. And tonight, we have a very special within special program. This is a summer program, a timeless program of celebration. Yes, we're celebrating the old America we all, old enough to remember it, cherish. It's Christian values and its stress on individual enterprise and achievement, and even some bits of humor that are purely American. All the things that make an American so different from a European, quote, world citizen. Tonight, we will also feature some key reminiscences, extended reminiscences from Dr. Dennis L. Cuddy. In his new book, Conspiracy 2, he has a chapter called Once Upon a Time, 1960. Dennis will be a storyteller tonight with some fascinating tales. Yes, he's Irish, and so am I. Who but an Irishman can tell the best stories? And his will be telling you about growing up there, his younger years in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I personally hope he tells you all about the three singers. Yes, one was Elvis. And listeners, in a little more serious vein, the times we are definitely going into, you do want to get Dr. Cuddy's new book, Conspiracy 2. I think it's around $20. That won't make or break anyone, and it has some very vital information in it, including the origin of the COVID shot and that whole business. Here is the phone number for information and ordering information, 1-800-652-1144. And again, that book's name is Conspiracy 2, 1-800-652-1144. Listeners, we're not far now from July the 4th, and we begin our program of celebrating the old America with something for you to relax with and just chuckle a little, recalling the joys of your own fond memories of yesteryear. Lou begins with an endearing essay about childhood by author Rick Bragg. Take it away, Lou.
All right. This is from Southern Living, the June-July edition of this year. It's by Rick Bragg. A banana pudding confession. Sometimes forbidden fruit is meant to be eaten. Somewhere, far back in my failing memory, a six-year-old boy stands in the open door of an old Frigidaire, a giant, translucent green Tupperware bowl cradled in one bony arm. He has a steel spoon the size of a shovel in his free hand and is digging with grim purpose into the treasure within. It is just some sliced bananas, vanilla pudding, and vanilla wafers mingling under a cool layer of whipped cream. But from the sheer determination on his face, you would think it were a thing that has never been created before, not in the long history of this world, and never could be again. He is barefoot and wearing pajamas with buckling horses on them, though it is a bit hard to tell under all the pudding that somehow missed his mouth. Because the spoon is too wide to fit in his jaws, and the bowl is too big around to afford much of a grip, he has vanilla wafers sliding down his arms, whipped cream in his hair, and bananas between his toes. He knows full well that what he is doing is wrong, so wrong. And he had tried, really tried, to do the right thing. He had watched his mother prepare it before going to bed, and nodded, like the good boy he was, when she told him not to touch it, that it was promised for his Grandma Ava's birthday dinner the following day. But later that night, after the lights were cut off, and the night birds were singing outside his window, he couldn't get it out of his mind. It called to him, softly at first and then insistently, till he couldn't bear it and slipped down the hall in the pitch dark. He followed the clank, rattle, and hum of the old refrigerator, fumbled for the handle, and then, Lord, how it almost seemed to shine. He knew better than to risk the clatter of plates. His mama was a light sleeper. She could hear a car on the highway 5 miles away, or perceive the latch lifting on the kitchen door. So he grabbed the big mixing spoon off the counter, gently propped open the lid, and dug in. At first, he intended to take only a bite or two, but, well, you know. So here he stands. He pushes the lid back on. It's a lot louder than he would have liked. He licks the spoon clean and then polishes it with his shirt tail. He knows his mama will see that the level of the pudding has receded, but already has a plan for this. He will blame his little brother, or maybe a cat burglar. It's the perfect crime. Almost. He pads silently back down the hall to his bed, oblivious to the trail of sticky footprints that will, in the accusing light of day, seal his doom. I thought about this memory the other day when I heard people discussing recipes for this most southern of dishes and what it takes to make a genuine banana pudding. It has to be warm, or it has to be cold, or it has to be covered in a lofty meringue, which must be toasted, or must not be toasted, or I don't know. Y'all can fight about it if you have the time, but I do know what perfection is. You can't just make a perfect pudding. You have to steal one.
Thank you, Lou.
You're welcome.
And, you know, Lou and I have many times marveled at the amazing, quote, coincidences God used to get us both to Maryland, him from Hamilton, Massachusetts, and me from near Bedford, Pennsylvania, so that we could meet. Out of nowhere, a fellowship at the University of Maryland opened up for Lou. Suddenly, without warning, I lost my working fellowship with student teachers and in the reading department in the field of reading itself at West Virginia University, Morgantown. I had to hunt for a job in Maryland. Now, as for Lou, getting back to him a couple years after that, an apartment manager was at lunch when Lou visited, so to kill time, he decided to check on a high-rise apartment building down the street. Yes, an apartment was vacant, about two doors down from yours truly. The rest is destiny, as they say. Even in Lou's and my early lives, it appears that God was molding our character by both great preachers and teachers, and, you know, he was influencing us, giving us this love of history from past historical greats that we read about. For Lou, it was an indirect acquaintance with people and things integral to the great General George S. Patton, as he will now tell you.
Riding in Patton's tank. As a boy growing up in Hamilton, Massachusetts, history was all around me. When I was 3 or 4, I loved to watch nearby trains go by. When we rode on one of those trains to Salem, I would admire the old gray granite Salem Depot. I was so young and small that looking up at the structure, it made me think of a medieval castle. It had two towers on either side and a huge arch in between with enough room for two trains to pass through at the same time. As a train approached, 4 men would come out and hold up signs saying, "Stop," to halt the automobile traffic passing in front of the station. As I look at pictures of the depot now, I see why I was so angry as a small child when it was torn down. It really was a spellbinding castle. Any of you who want to see what I mean can view photos of it on the internet. Just search for Old Salem, Massachusetts Depot. Something else was even more fascinating to me than the old depot, a certain World War II Sherman tank. Every summer day, I walked a half mile to Patton Park, named in honor of General George S. Patton. The town of Hamilton had established the large park, which had tennis courts, baseball and softball fields, a skating pond, and a section for children's rides, swings, seesaws, slides, and so on. But the place of honor in the center of the park was occupied by the Sherman tank. Soon after World War II, when my brother, 8 years older than I, was small, children were allowed to climb inside the tank. But by the time I was growing up, the hatch had been welded shut to prevent possible injuries or vandalism. I remember that one day during the turbulent 60s, when traditional American values were first coming under attack, some jerk had no respect for Patton and painted the tank pink. So I had to be content to climb on the outside of the tank. George S. Patton came to live in Hamilton after he married Beatrice Eyre, a member of an old, wealthy Hamilton family. The general spent a great deal of his time away from home due to the demands of his military career. But he considered Hamilton his permanent home.
And, Lou, I think you were telling me, too, that when that tank was sealed up, you thought that was like a kind of a symbolism, a metaphor for something else. Are you going to tell us about that?
I am, yes.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes.
We look forward to that. And since I interrupted your reminiscence, another little funny one was that you were talking about you and your mother, and you were really tiny, going somewhere. Was it to that park where you saw the outhouse?
No, that was to the town cemetery. My dad, between jobs, he was working at the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Navy Yard, but once World War II ended, he was often laid off for a period of 6 to 8 weeks. And the town would hire him at the cemetery to mow grass, things like that. Well, my mother took me to the cemetery to visit him one time, maybe more than once, and there was this outhouse, which I had to use, and I thought this was a tremendous thing. I thought, why can't we have one of those in our backyard?
But when you ask that to your mother, she didn't show much enthusiasm, did she?
No, she wouldn't go along with that.
But
that's
now,
right.
Getting back to Patton, and listeners, listen for the part when Lou tells you what that boarded-up tank can symbolize to all of us, you see, who are patriots.
Yes, that's right. And I should mention that the Patton estate, where he did occasionally live, when in between his assignments, was located on the outskirts of the town of Hamilton, 3 or 4 miles from my home. As a college student, I tutored one of the young boys in the Eyre family, probably a distant relative of the general's wife. I remember the beautiful house and the fact that the family was very welcoming and friendly. A few years later, the boy I had tutored was riding recklessly on his sled and drove it right out into the road and into the path of an oncoming car. He was a lucky boy. He escaped with only a few bruises. Once I was old enough to learn some history, I realized why the town would name a plaque for General Patton, one of the most successful and controversial commanders of World War II. He made his reputation as a decisive and skilled tank commander in North Africa, France, and Germany. After the war, Patton held an administrative post in occupied Germany. He was one of the first to warn about the ambitions of the Soviet Union. His outspoken views unnerved the military establishment. Was he targeted for later assassination? Robert K. Wilcox's book, Target Patton, gives his answer to that question. In December 1945, following a mysterious auto accident, Patton seemed to be recovering. His doctors gave the go-ahead for him to return home. Then he suddenly died. Something struck his heart. The Army ruled the crash an accident, nothing more, and they said his death resulted from natural causes. However, Robert Wilcox says, quote, witness testimony on the crash conflicted. Key players in the incident disappeared. Official reports vanished. Soldiers were ordered to keep silent, and there was no autopsy performed on the body, unquote. Just like with the JFK death, the cover-up was on. As a young boy climbing on that tank in Patton Park, I was oblivious to the mystery surrounding the death of that great man. It's only in the last few decades that I have come to understand that there were forces at work that would think nothing of murdering your national hero if it suited their purposes. The world is not the simple, placid place I envisioned as I played outdoors on those summer days at Patton Park. As a newscaster and watchman God has called me to be, I now, as an adult, fully understand how very appropriate and worthy it was for the town to place the memorial tank honoring General George S. Patton in the center of Patton Park.
Yes, Lou, that legacy of the assassinations from JFK on down through Sonny Bono, perhaps, we have to be awakened because we have to know the truth about our country. And one of these changing moments for me in childhood was my chance as an 8-year-old to play Lady Liberty on stage. My beloved teacher in grades 2 through 5 in a one-room school was Paul Kerr. Mr. Kerr was a kindly, soft-spoken World War II veteran. He became like a second father to my brother and me, taking us with his own children on Saturdays to a theater in a nearby town. There, we eagerly watched Roy Rogers movies and even some older Randolph Scott flicks. Mr. Kerr did a lot of woodworking, and he made me a miniature dough tray that I still cherish. And for my, quote, performance, he carved out a wooden torch with a wooden flame. I was to hold this as I talked and stirred my melting pot. During my emoting on stage, my parents noticed my constant eye blinking. It turned out I was nearsighted and needed glasses. I was also on the child speaking circuit for the local WCTU. That's the Women's Christian Temperance Union. As a member of it, my mother held me as a baby and had a white ribbon tied on my wrist, as my mother promised never to serve liquor as long as she lived to me. And as a part of the kids division, a little later, the LTL, that stood for the Loyal Temperance Legion, I entered more speaking contests, earning a silver and gold medal. These selections mostly were describing the very detrimental results in people's lives from alcoholism, and they had to be memorized. So my mother always sat in the back of the church or the audience, the auditorium, wherever it was held, with the prompting book in her lap. And this was in case I had a memory lapse. One time she forgot to bring the book. Of course, that was the very time that my mischievous little brother, 3 years younger, chose to start making silly faces at me. And, of course, I won no award that time, and I chased him all around the house when I got home. In those years, when the ordinary people lived mostly in goodness and decency, I would have been shocked to the core to know that the Statue of Liberty, my onstage persona, was a much more complicated icon. Lou, it's just like you with Patton's tank. It was not a straightforward symbol of American freedom. I simply wouldn't have been able to understand how the French Illuminati, a secret society, gifted America with the statue. Why? Many of us lived then in our own Mayberry. And with that, we change the locale. Lou moved us from Maryland here, where we're broadcasting, up back up to Massachusetts. Then I talked about Western Pennsylvania. Now we're going to go further south to Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome, Dennis Cuddy, storyteller.
Thanks for having me. Want me to tell a story?
Yeah.
Oh, a lot of stories. Yes, and we referred to your book, and we told people how to buy it again, Conspiracy 2, and the chapter about Once Upon a Time, 1960. You know, we're going to enjoy ourselves today. We know that a lot of our listeners are really burned out. They're just fed things that are so frightening, the truth about all these dangers coming, the loss of food, engineered collapse of money, all these things. But we have to remember God Almighty is still in control. And we do remember that at the first time we were making this program, we look back and see that God did a wonderful miracle in 2022. He reversed Roe v. Wade. He overturned it. And so we know that that's sort of a hint that God may want us to work harder to try to let the people know what these old values and customs and the goodness and the integrity of the old America in the ordinary people's lives. The elite were always there doing their thing. They weren't quite as technologically advanced then. But we think that we might celebrate this type of program again, probably in November, right before Thanksgiving, when I will tell how my mother got the Ayatollah mixed up with a car maker. But so today, again, we do ask the listeners to think about helping Dennis. He had an injury lately, and many more bills came. And so right now, Lou and I are in good shape with WWCR for July. You have helped us, listeners, very much. But if you would like to send something to help Dennis Cuddy, we always send it on to him. You could send a money order made out to him. You could send a check to us, and then we can get it transferred to him. Or you can just write a check to him, send it to us. That would be the easiest thing, and we will send it on to him, or some cash. We'll make sure he gets it all. So again, if you would like to help Dennis this time, send it to Lou Caverly, C-A-V-E-R-L-Y, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, B-E-T-H-L-E-H-E-M, Maryland. And the zip, Lou always tells me I go too fast. Lou, don't you?
I do.
It's 21609. And again, that's P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. So we might come back again and do this program in the fall. We're going to be talking about a lot of the occult things coming up. And possibly in July, we might even get into Bohemian Grove and some of that. And it's very important that we announce to you listeners that next week, and that would be on the 29th for the Thursday listeners. And when we're first taping this, the Global Star people will hear it live. So that would be the 28th. We expect to have Chris Pinto. And he's a very important filmmaker, documentary filmmaker. And we will be talking to him about the Christian roots of America. And the later point, we hope to have him back to give the evil side of it, his documentary series sometime back on the secret beginnings of America. So we believe that God is bringing a number of us together. Those who are not sold out, not the grifters who are getting the big world paychecks, we know for a fact that Dennis Cuddy has gotten not very much money in royalties on his books. And I just have to tell you, Dennis, that I do know that Gary Kaw, when he wrote En Route to Global Occupation, I know this because I was trying to get my books, Patriots Warning 1, Patriots Warning 2, America Attacked, and Chaos and Chemtrails. I was trying to work with Huntington House, and it was the publisher that had published Gary Kaw's amazing book, En Route to Global Occupation. But I think that it was a New World Order outfit that quickly bought it up. With something called Alpha Publishing, I think. And anyway, of course, everything then was done for me. Nothing pursued my book. But at any rate, I know that Gary Kaw's book, I believe, maybe made him $100,000, or it sold 100,000 copies. At any rate, he said it was enough to bankroll his whole ministry beginning. Dennis did not have that advantage, and we're going to point out to you listeners that God is watching all of the Christian programs and organizations, and don't be fooled. I've begun to not send any money anywhere, haven't I, Lou?
Yes, that's true.
No, we're putting everything into this program. We do. There is one group that we do give money to, and that is the police in Maryland, the state troopers. A couple times they helped Lou right at a traffic light where his car had been disabled. We think they're good, and we do think it's very important to support the police. Occasionally we will send something to the Maryland Food Bank, but again, you don't know whether it's getting there. We would prefer, and this is what we usually do, we help those in our local network, or we hear about someone right nearby who needs help, and that's when we give a little bit of food or help. So we think God is bringing us all together. So do tune in next week to hear Chris Pinto. And, of course, we'll be getting Dennis back. We know we will at various times. So now I've taken a lot of your time, but I do want to hear about those three singers. I want to hear about your growing up, Dennis. Take it away.
Well, you've made a lot of comments. I just want to briefly say something before I get into my Once Upon a Time piece.
Sure. Listen, you can respond all you like. We're giving you the whole rest of the program.
Okay. Gary Kaw had some very good material, and it's very difficult to find a copy of the frontispiece of Madame Blavatsky's and Annie Besant's Lucifer publication, Lucifer Monthly. But I was able to get one of those and provided it to him, so you will see a copy of that frontispiece of Lucifer magazine in his book. He is like a little angel of light coming down, to, which the Bible says he can, you know, Satan can appear as an angel of light. Also, you had mentioned the Statue of Liberty. You might have your listeners look at a four-part series I did on the Statue of Liberty and its real meaning, because it's modeled after the Babylonian Semiramis goddess, and the History Channel actually had me as a consultant on a program about that, the real meaning of the Statue of Liberty as well. Okay, now, the story, once upon a time, I was trying to show how things in the past, I guess they called it the sleepy Eisenhower years, were not what they were since then. And it was, I just thought things just happened. But I learned later that things didn't just happen. You had wholesome food. Coca-Cola was made with cane sugar. Fresh tomatoes. Where I am in Raleigh, there's NC State University, and unfortunately they're responsible for engineering a new type of tomato for long-range shipping. It's more solid. I used to jokingly say you could bounce it off the floor rather than the wholesome, fresh tomatoes that we used to have. So you've had a lot of things done to our crops. You've had various seeds taken over by Monsanto, but then I was wondering at that time, well, why Monsanto? And then I figured out another book of mine was about the secret Nazi plan. Lo and behold, Bayer buys up Monsanto. So that fits with the puzzle that I was putting together, that the secret Nazi plan is coming to fulfillment now. So in the 50s, you had a lot of naivete, but it was a wholesome sort of thing. You used to walk everywhere you went. Even the cars were nicer. They had pastel colors, pastel blue and pink and green and so forth. Now you have this sort of bland grayness and so on. And used to, as children, have a really good time. And by that, I don't mean weirdo cartoons. I mean, you used to have a lot of physical activity. Parents used to try to develop their children's health and skills. You would be taught a variety of dances. And it wasn't just the modern dance. There was a respect for the older dances, too. You would take ballroom dancing and the foxtrot and so forth like that, as well as the more modern dances. So there was a historical continuity going on at that time. And then all of a sudden the 1960s hit. And I thought later, I said, well, that's just too bad. It's unfortunate. But later on, I learned that this was all rather a deliberate plot. In my first book of this type called Now is the Dawning of the New Age, New World Order, I put quotation marks around the mothers of invention, the Jefferson Airplane, and the Who, and they would literally say, what we're doing with our music is creating a generation gap. We're separating the values of the youth with the values of their parents. And it wasn't, you know, it was not wholesome and nice and uplifting. There was a shift from what I would call biblical values to the values and slogans in the late 60s of groups called the hippies. They would say, look out for number one. What's in it for me? If it feels good, do it. Free love, that sort of thing. And so by the 60s, that really got going. And by the early 70s, you had groups, very prominent groups like the National Education Association, beginning to participate in this type of thing. They had already started in the 60s shifting education emphasis from the cognitive basics, reading, writing, math, to the affective domain, social relationships, feelings, things like that. And so in the early 70s, Catherine Barrett was head of the NEA, and she wrote an article in the Saturday Review of Education which said, today, in the early 70s, we emphasize the basics for almost all the school day. She said, we're going to change that. We're going to change that and downgrade that to just one quarter of the school day so that the teacher can rise to her or his true calling, which is a philosophical change agent. And I did one of the other books I did is a 200-year chronology of education with about a 3,000-item index in it. And in there, I put a lot of very specific things, like the U.S. Department of Education would provide funding, I think it was about $7 million in the early 70s, for 500 of these change agents who would go across the nation, changing the emphasis of education, downgrading what we would call the basics on purpose. It was all strategically planned.
We want to interrupt there to have you go back now as a contrast to that world that's approaching there with the change agents. What were some of the wholesome things that you as a child experienced that you remember? Can you tell us what the life was like there? You mentioned in your book there were things at the YWCA, YMCA, various things. What was it life like?
Well, life was health sort of oriented. You would have wholesome games. I remember you would play normal games, table tennis, basketball, go fish if you played a card game like that on a rainy day. The food, as I said, was natural. It hadn't been pumped full of artificial ingredients. It was a slower pace.
What do you remember? What are some foods that you remember, some highlights of that?
Well, in the foods, my uncle had what we call luncheonettes, and he used to deliberately bring fresh tomatoes from his garden, banana pudding with real whipped cream. He would have fresh flounder brought from the coast that morning and served at lunch at his cafeteria. It was an emphasis on wholesome, unpolluted foods that was very, very nourishing and healthy. When I was in school, for example, in the public school, we had fish sticks, for example, that was included flounder, not the sort of mysterious stuff they have today. You would actually have, I mean, today you have a lot of, well, let's give the kids what they want, pizzas and so forth. No. We had really fresh, and the kids really loved, mashed potatoes, chicken, a nice, wholesome hamburger. Not with, you know, strange meat and so forth. Really fresh-baked, homemade rolls that the children would do. You would gain a nourishment. It wasn't just, let's just throw something at the children and let them do whatever they want to.
Let me interrupt there because I think we're going to open up this little part to Lou and me as well. Lou, where you were, there were a lot of seafood things. Can you describe things that you had that you liked? Things tasted better then. There wasn't as much pollution in the ocean either.
No, there wasn't. And with what Dennis has said, it reminds me that my favorite teacher was the math teacher, and his wife was the head of the school cafeteria when I was in high school. And although I was rather picky and sometimes brought my lunch, when I did eat it at the school, it was delicious. It had nourishment. As Dennis said, none of this pizza kind of stuff that you see today. And I remember there were many little stands that you could buy fresh seafood, including shellfish. One of my favorites was fried clams up there. And unlike the clams down here in Maryland, you got the whole clam. It was much more substantial. And I can remember all kinds of...
You liked clam chowder, too, didn't you?
Oh, yes. My mother, we weren't rich, so my mother would buy a can of clam chowder. And I think she bought some clams to go with it, and then she'd add potatoes to kind of stretch it a little. But that was delicious. She'd also get corned beef hash in a can. But then she'd cook potatoes, you know, so that they were fairly soft. I can remember as a little boy, my mother had a great big wooden bowl, about foot and a half across, and I always had the honor of chopping up the potatoes and the corned beef hash and mixing it together with a chopper. So those are a few of the food memories.
Yes, and you know, there again, you're showing how the mothers were not all shoved out to go to work under the agenda that was coming, the change agenda, agent agenda.
That's
so
true.
Your mother could teach you.
Yeah, my mother never worked after she married.
And my mother was a college graduate and did not go back to teaching till my brother was 8 years old. So we had a lot of interaction with my mother, too, and I always laugh because my brother learned how to do canning, and I didn't. But it was an interesting thing for me, too, as you know, when you first began to hang around with me in the early 80s, you went up to Pennsylvania, and you found the world's best Pennsylvania Dutch cook, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
That
yeah.
was my mother.
That's
and,
right.
And some of those wonderful recipes, the top pies, I think, were lemon sponge pie. And if anybody ever wants that recipe, you just write to Lou Caverly, P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609, and I'll copy out the recipe. But essentially, it is a pie that has a liquid sort of bottom and sweet, and then it has a little bit of a cakey top. And that is the lemon. Another pie was a graham cracker pie. And we could still find them at a little local restaurant when we first came out here to the Eastern Shore. Of course, that disappeared.
Yeah, I should interject, too.
Go ahead.
I always thought it was ironic that when the little restaurant closed down, the folks got too old to have it, it was turned into one of these little medical places where
yes.
you could come. And I used to kid and say that that's the medical place is to take care of all the folks who got heart disease by eating all the high-fat foods at the restaurant there.
But it was a kind of a, oh, it was a landmark.
Oh, yes.
H&G. We used to nickname it Hog and Grits.
Yeah, it started the year I was born, so it was around a long time.
And the key owner collected trains,
like
little trains for under trees. And you watched one woman one time about the salt. Tell about the salt.
No, this was a man.
Oh, it was a man.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was checking out. I'd gotten a takeout order, and a man who was seated at a booth very close to the checkout started putting salt in his food, and he just kept going and on and on and on. And, he must have taken 10 seconds just putting salt on. It must have been enough to cause his blood pressure to go up 50 or 100 points. I don't
know. Probably didn't live too long.
Probably
not. But isn't this an innocent story compared to me talking to you earlier today about my obituary watch, and I saw that a certain doctor's son, and this man probably was about 55, died suddenly, and we knew of his father, the doctor, who worked along with another doctor whose children we tutored years ago. So I said to you, undoubtedly, he was vaccinated with the COVID-19 shot because he's in that medical establishment milieu, died suddenly. But tonight, we are still thinking about the enjoyable things. And, you know, even I mentioned Mayberry, and TV was different. Now, Dennis, I think you found an old program, MacGyver. I never watched it. It must have been in years when I wasn't at home or something. Maybe you can tell the listeners you still get a little enjoyment out of something old that was good.
Sure. They still have, you know, if you look at, like MeTV, Memorable Entertainment, at 8 o'clock in the morning is Leave it to Beaver. You have the old Burns and Allen, Jack Benny shows. They have old music as well. When Jack Benny was on, he used to introduce a lot of young performers who then gained a reputation. And the music was, and that's one of the reasons I titled this particular chapter in the book, Once Upon a Time. If your listeners go to their cell phones and just type in Once Upon a Time, John Gary, it's not just that the melody is very sweet, but you can hear the lyrics, you can understand them, and they're not talking about sex and murder and violence. It's very romantic. The same thing with A Summer Place. They were calming songs, very calming. They weren't trying to stir you up. And only later did I find out why they started to have it rock and so forth, rock and roll, rock musicians, because there was an adrenaline high that these planners were created. That's why these young people would go, they would be getting high on their own adrenaline. And when you do that, you become more primitive, more animalistic, and easier to condition psychologically.
Yes, I think you may have mentioned this about the anapestic rhythm. And because
that's
I
right.
like poetry and I've written poetry, I knew what that meant. Da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da.
Yeah.
And it's that repetitious kind of hardcore
that's right.
Beat.
Yeah, as Bertrand Russell said in The Impact of Science on Society, what they would do is they would get the people to a stage where they would think snow was black. And they would do that by having verses set to music repeatedly in tone, so it would act like a Hindu mantra sinking into your subconscious.
And it certainly has worked that way.
Yes.
Well, let's get back to some more. This was very interesting there when you gave our listeners that website. That was John, what was his name again?
John Gary, G-A-R-Y. They had a bunch of summer replacement shows back in the 70s. John Gary, and he had a three-octave range, great singer, and that's the title of this song, Once Upon a Time. It's very meaningful lyrics. Now, you have the lyrics are dumbed down. It used to be music was a poem set to music. Now it's just repeatedly yelling and screaming about something.
Yes,
yeah.
And now what about the three singers? You're not going to get off that easily. We're going to find out who the three singers were.
Yeah. Well, I've had parents back then would give their children a variety of dance lessons and musical lessons and piano, guitar, all that sort of stuff. And so what I did was, because it was in the 60s, I put a picture of myself senior year at NC State University, where I was also very athletic in the tennis team and so on, and then a picture of Elvis, and then a picture of Ricky Nelson. And we looked very similar. The hairdo is sort of almost a bouffant type of large thing. And I jokingly somewhat said, I'm the best looking one of the three, and I have a better voice than any of the others, because I have two voices. I have the sort of crooner voice. I've had throat surgery since then, but it would be like, once upon a time, you know, like that, and then an operatic voice. And
not
I can't
bad.
Do that because I would break your eardrums of your listeners.
That was really pretty nice.
Yeah, that was good. That was good.
You and I love music. I don't know. I think he still has a hidden voice that he always said he couldn't carry a tune. He couldn't carry a tune. All through these years, if we were in a church, he didn't sing. Then I happened to hear him one day, and it was almost like George Beverly Shea. And I said, my goodness, you have a bass voice. But he said he couldn't read the music, but I think he can. And then with me, I have a wonderful speaking voice, but I always wanted to sing, but it seemed as though I could get no volume. And I was miscast as an alto in high school. And then I tried to take a few voice lessons in college. And at first, the instructor seemed very excited about me. And then it was like, ho-hum, nowhere. But in late years, I've realized that I can sing at a very high range with a lot of the great opera stars. But there's some creaking. And it isn't developed. I don't know. I think there is probably a flaw in my voice. But it's made me think that when I get to heaven, I think God is going to let me have my voice released, and I'll get to sing my opera there.
You'll be in the heavenly choir.
Yes, we saw the three pictures, and you were the better-looking one, best-looking one of
Thank
the three.
You. Yeah, I wish I had their money.
Yes. But this money business, it is such the love of evil. I mean, the love of money, it really is.
The love of money is the root of all evil. Yes, it is.
It really is. Let's think about some other things in those days, too. How about the Christian church? The Christian church. Now, by the time it got to my father, my Irish father, he says, the church is dead, the church is dead, the church is dead. And I had a handicapped cousin. We really heard the story later that the old doctor delivering her was intoxicated with alcohol.
Yeah.
And there was great damage done to her, and she had bandages on her head. So she seemed like not autistic, but more just brain damaged, I guess. She had some trouble talking, but she had a phenomenal memory. And I think her native intelligence, had she not been damaged, would have been you know, very, very high because she was an entrepreneur. She decided she would make all these things that you could do, crafts. She did embroidery, sewing, and then she had a business. She would sell it to people, and she would go up and down the little neighborhood and do all of this. Plus, she was the janitress at our church. Well, eventually, as these change agents came into the church, that wasn't good enough for her to be cleaning the church, and she did a wonderful job. They fired her. And my father came home, and in his cynical Irish way, he says, you know, the motto usually is hire the handicapped, but not at our church. It's fire the handicapped.
Yeah.
So, you know, we look back, and there was still a lot of good community love and close family ties, I think, in those years, too. Don't you think, Dennis?
Yes, absolutely. It's a multifaceted attack. Antonio Gramsci was a communist theoretician about 100 years ago, and he said, people don't really like these bloody revolutions, so we'll attack the culture. And it was all phases, dance, art, music, poetry, sports, everything. Everything. And I've written also a series on how they infiltrated the churches because you have to have not only a one-world government and economy, but a one-world religion, too. I mean, even the Catholic Church, you would have Paul VI saying, quote, the smoke of Satan is in the church in the mid-60s. That's what the Second Vatican Council was designed to do in that particular. But I go into Methodists and Baptists and so forth. One of the first books that's ever titled The New World Order was published by Samuel Zane Batten by the American Baptist Association or Society in 1919, and he's advocating, and the Baptists are publishing, we need a socialist world government. So this effort has been multifaceted throughout all the religions. It's a massive plot.
What was the date on his book, 1919?
1919, The New World
wow.
Order. Yeah, it's the first book
wow.
that I can find that had that title, and it was by him, published by the American, I think it was American Baptist Society, they think they called him at the time. Advocating a socialist world government.
That shows us, too, how Satan's power has been planning this for millennia,
yep.
doesn't it?
Absolutely.
It's nothing new.
This has been going
a
long
time. It's nothing
time.
That has just arisen overnight.
That's right. No, it's well thought out, and it's very careful and gradual. In fact, that's part of the reason it's been successful. The symbols of the Fabian socialists are a tortoise or a wolf in sheep's clothing, moving slow, gradually, so imperceptibly that the public doesn't realize. It's like the frog in the water. You know, put the frog in the water, turn up the heat. He doesn't even know that he's being cooked alive.
Exactly.
That's right.
Lou, what do you think about all this?
Yes, I think there are a few things you can point to that were sudden, such as taking the prayer out of the schools and Bible readings, and I don't know what year that was. Do you
1960.
Know? 1960. Yeah, I remember that.
The early
small 60s
child. Is like Torcaso versus Watkins.
Oh, yes, yes. Now, but what Dennis says is true. An awful lot of the things were gradual. So you didn't notice it as they were happening. But when you look back, you can say, oh, my gosh, things have just changed so completely.
By the way, I'm the one who got the prayer back in the schools. I changed the argument. They were getting nowhere with freedom of religion versus separation of church and state. So I changed the argument to freedom of speech. And I said, if little Susie can voluntarily say thank you, teacher, she has to be able to say voluntarily thank you, God, or else you're discriminating on the basis of the content of her speech. So now you can once again have voluntary prayer in the schools.
Well, that's excellent. If you were a large part of doing that, that's very good. You wouldn't have time and have your materials nearby to go into the Statue of Liberty, would you, your articles?
They're not handy. I can get them out for the next program.
Yes,
all right.
At a later time we'll do that. You know, I've just been looking over, and Lou has too, the latest book by Jonathan Cahn, and in it, we're looking at the goddess, Ishtar,
right.
And how all the similarities at the Stonewall happening, and we're coming up pretty close on the anniversary date of that. I think 54 years ago, I believe it's something like June 28th, if I'm not mistaken, but how many parallels there were between this goddess Ishtar and the things that happened there at Stonewall. And actually, the goddess was known for breaking down walls, stone walls, and being very violent and pushing her way through gates. And, of course, give me the name of the book. I'm having a little lapse.
The Return of the Gods.
Yes, The Return of the Gods. And anyway, he points out that this sort of had to happen in New York because of the gateway, you see, is the Statue of Liberty, the goddess. So that fit in. And then apparently in the mythology, going back, there was a woman who was very key at getting all the violence started, and so there really was one woman there among all the transgendered men and everybody else, the male prostitutes. There was a very masculine woman who worked as a male impersonator during the day, and of course, this thing really began to break out just the way the parallel was in the mythological parts of the story. And finally, the police were barricaded within the bar. And down the street, there was a bar that had opened earlier called the Lion's Head, a couple years earlier. And, of course, the Mafia had both of these taverns, and the Stonewall and the Lion's Head. And that also fit right in with the parallel in the mythology of having the key, I don't know what you would call it, emblem, I guess, of the goddess being a lion's head. And so when we look back, we can see a lot of symbolism, and we can see a lot of odd things in names of people. You know, I was talking to Lou again. We were talking about how the Obama years began much of the change. And, of course, it's not us revealing something big anymore. Many news outlets have said that Michael Obama is a man. And we're not saying that we know for sure that that's true. But it has been alleged. And, of course, Obama began so many things with Obamacare, many things. And it's very easy to take his name and say Obama Nation. So we can look at other names, too, if we look at it. They seem to be metaphorical, and it seems like we're coming closer to the fulfillment of this plan if we don't, as Christians, stand up. Okay, maybe Franklin Graham and Albert Mohler and Pope Francis would tell their flock to go get the aborted fetal-derived shots that will kill them. Maybe they could do that, but we have other Christians. We have people listening to this program, and don't underrate the ability of your prayers, any of you. Lou and I weren't always strong about believing when we prayed. Last year, two listeners in the same mailing wrote to us, "Believe your old property will be sold, declare it sold." And God did a miracle. There are many other miracles of healing that people have seen. So we don't want you out there to think it's inevitable that the world government is coming tomorrow. Repentance can still happen. And we think that it's very important that Dennis Cuddy's books get out to people. And we hope that we'll be interviewing you again about some of those earlier ones. The Secret Records Revealed looks like an interesting one, Dennis.
That's the one that's based upon Cecil Rhodes, who is also on the Conspiracy No. 1 volume. His picture's on the cover because he was forming a society, secret society of the elect, modeled after the Jesuits, to, as he said, take the government of the world, and Bill Clinton would be the sort of fulfillment of that, because I have a letter, 1993, signed by Bill Clinton to the World Federalist Association, wishing them future success. So he was definitely the planned product of that secret society. And the reason they used the term secret records is he loved these secret society people so much that they allowed him to look at their, quote, secret records for 2 years, beginning in the early 1960s. And I have the original tapes of the interview the Washington Post did with Bill Clinton. His mentor, Professor Carol Quigley at Georgetown University, which is a Jesuit institution, and they titled their article, "The Professor Who Knew Too Much." This man knows
exactly
too much.
And we have heard that Bill Clinton's real father is a Rockefeller. We don't know whether we can, substantiate that, but it would lend credence to his extreme facilitation in getting to the top of the power structure. And now we're getting low on time, but again, we want you listeners out there to enjoy your families and not live in great fear. Try to eat real meat that you can find locally. And if you must buy grocery store meat, please, as Mike Adams, the health ranger, says, cook it very well. It may disable the mRNA. Lou and I have been rather busy with many, many different things. And so we don't know the latest status of whether the Cattlemen's Association has okayed putting the mRNA in to the beef. And then we heard that it may have been clandestinely put into the pork for the last decade. So you don't want to be going there buying the Bill Gates meat substitutes either. We had a program in which we talked to you about many, many harmful substances in Beyond Meat, including pea protein. And yours truly had about 11 years of kidney stones, hanging on, every couple days in misery. And I was eating this product, I think it was an early harbinger of Beyond Meat, and it had a kind of a pea protein in it. And these things make purines in the body. Dried beans do it. Gravies can do it. If you get too much of that in, some people are susceptible, you see, then you can't get rid of something called uric acid, and then you make kidney stones. Well, we quit eating that after we got the information about the Beyond Meat, the pea protein, and it's like everything went away. The kidney stones went away. So you must look at your food. You can find some natural food, and please don't eat farm-raised fish. Dennis, you talked about these strange fish things, tilapia. Most of that is farm-raised. But do you have a parting word or two for us, Dennis?
Anticipating the next program, remember about the Statue of Liberty. If you look at her, it is Semiramis, Semiramus, the ancient goddess, including the seven rays coming from the head.
Wonderful. Wonderful tip to us. We'll look forward to that. And may God bless you, Dennis. And may God bless all of you listeners. And we thank you for tuning in tonight. Good night.